Last week here I gave a talk on conceit, and as I was leaving I thought that in my mind that what would make a nice follow-up talk on conceit is compassion. And so today's talk somehow is about compassion, but you might have to keep that in mind yourself. It might not be obvious as it goes along here. And because it's raining today, I also reminded of a parable, which I sometimes teach about when it rains, called the Parable of the Plants, which is taught in a famous Mahayana discourse called the Lotus Sutra. And the way it goes is that when it rains in the forest, it rains equally in all the plants, in the trees and the herbs and the grasses, whatever. But each plant, according to its need, pulls up different water, different amounts of water. Each plant takes in what it needs. So in the same way, the rain of the Dharma is falling on all of us equally. But each person takes in just what they need. As different people take in different things, different amounts, different experiences, different things at different times. So so that's why if there's 30 retreats, 30 people on a retreat, there are 30 different retreat experiences, because each person takes from that experience what is needed for themselves. So the idea of rain, and this idea of rain, each person takes in what they need, reminds me a little bit of a sponge, the way we absorb things. And as we go through life, it's possible to absorb the Dharma, absorb the truth in a way that has some impact on us. And in thinking about compassion today, I was thinking that it might be important to distinguish between knowledge and understanding. So there's all kinds of things you can know, facts, for example. So you can know facts about compassion. And one of my favorite facts these days about compassion is that it seems that loving compassion, gestures of compassion, have been measured in the human body to create oxytocin. And oxytocin is a chemical that courses through the blood system. And it comes into play in various key moments in some people's lives. Oxytocin is produced when mothers breastfeed. And oxytocin is produced at childbirth. Oxytocin is produced, apparently, when some people eat chocolate. Oxytocin is apparently produced when people are massaged. And one of the functions of oxytocin is to create a, well, not a function, but one of the results of this chemical is it produces a sense of well-being in the system. And so when there's clean compassion, when there's compassion without any anxiety, then this chemical called oxytocin is released in our blood system, and it produces a sense of well-being. And I think that's a very interesting fact. It points to some very interesting ideas. One of the things it points to is the idea that compassion is something biological, something very deeply built into the structure of being a human being. And that there might be reasons for that, because the sense of well-being that gets produced as we breastfeed or give birth or eat chocolate or do acts of compassion to each other is self-reinforcing, because it brings a sense of well-being. And so part of the reason people will do these things is not because they're altruistic, but because they're, in some sense, maybe, I don't know if selfish is the right word, but it does something wonderful to ourselves. And that's been my experience, is that compassion was not a concept that existing in my working vocabulary when I started Buddhist practice. I had no interest in compassion. And slowly, the compassion kind of crept up on me. And I realized after a while that it would not only was crept up on me, it became a very important part of my experience of who I am. But it wasn't something that required self-sacrifice. It wasn't like I was a compassionate person, I'm going to sacrifice myself. I often had the sense that the sense of love or compassion or care, kindness that seemed to be welling up slowly in my practice, was kind of, in a sense, who I am. And it wasn't sacrificing myself to be compassionate, it was actually a fulfillment of myself. And I found it very strange that, somewhat strange, the degree to which I felt good when I felt compassionate. And maybe I had a little bit of sense that when you're compassionate, you're supposed to feel lousy. And certainly there are people who have this idea that occasionally that you only show that you really care about someone who's in distress by being in distress yourself, and you worry and fret. But to be calm and stable and loving or caring doesn't have to produce any distress for ourselves, but actually can bring about a calm presence in a situation that maybe needs calmness. So we can know the facts about oxytocin and know and be perplexed, or be challenged or be inspired by the way that's built into our biological system. So it might have, but that's in the knowledge. I can tell you knowledge about that. And then juxtaposition to knowledge is what I'm calling understanding. And the reason I'm choosing the word understanding today to juxtapose against knowledge is because if you turn the two parts of understanding around, you have the expression standing under. And so when we understand something by standing under it. We have a culture where people sometimes want to be outstanding, and I prefer the term instanding. Let's all become instanding. And to stand in our experience, or to stand under our experience. So what this means to me is the idea that when something happens to us, we can understand it or know it, knowledge about it as something external, or we can somehow allow ourselves to be like a sponge that absorbs that experience, that really takes it in, really takes it in well and carefully, no matter what it might be. And that there's value in taking in our experience, standing under experience, standing long enough for something to happen or the experience to penetrate in some deeper kind of way. Most of you have the experience of judging someone negatively, and then never really talk to, you see them a distance, and then they sit down next to you, or you have some occasion to hang out with them, and you start hearing something about their life, and you find out their troubles or their background, and somehow your judgments dissolve because you had took the time to really take in this person. You've taken them in. You stood under them in a sense to understand what's going on with who they really are, and you can have knowledge about the person, but to somehow absorb the experience of that person, take it in, and allow it to work on our inner life, to work on our heart, is a very different experience than having knowledge. So part of the function of meditation practice is to become an understanding person, an in-standing person, someone who can stand under our experience. And and when you see meditation in this way, then meditation is not about having some pristine, wonderful, perfect meditative experience. We're chasing after the perfect experience, some abstract idea of some mystical state or meditative state. There are wonderful states of meditation that can be attained. But sometimes when people are focused on attaining a rarefied meditative state, and they're trying to find the technique for that, that state and the path to it might have nothing to do with our life. And in fact, sometimes the pursuit of rarefied meditative states is not very helpful for people. Sometimes it actually leads to greater conceit. And sometimes it lends itself to kind of hold part of themselves at bay. Another way of thinking about meditation is that meditation is not about a technique to get someplace, but rather it's a way to let things get to us, let our experiences get to us. So no matter what's going on in our life, we sit down to meditate, and we discover, when we sit down to meditate, what is really the currents of our psyche, or psychology, or emotions, or feelings, or thoughts, or concerns, that are really need to be digested, need to be looked at, need to somehow, that are powerful and working in us. We discover what's working in us. And then as we discover what's working in us, it might be different than what we thought was working in us. And then the art of meditation is learning how to stand under those things, absorb it, take it in a way that is helpful for us, that's useful. So you might. So what this also implies then is that this kind of meditation isn't very pretty. Sometimes it is, but it's about your life as it is, as opposed to some, you know, beautiful, pristine meditative experiences. So sometimes your life is beautiful, and so you take that in as you meditate. You feel the joy and the happiness of it, the peace. And sometimes your life is distressed, or a lot of sorrow or sadness or fear. And so rather than sitting down and thinking, oh, I'm not supposed to be afraid, that's not real meditation. Meditation is to give the time for yourself, for your heart, to take in what's really going on for you. So, oh, that's what's happening. It's not what I was hoping meditation was going to be like today, but it turns out that fear is what's happening. Okay, what is it like to take this in? Take in the fear, the sadness, or the happiness, whatever it might be. Let's take it in. And some people might protest and say, well, taking it in is just going to make me feel lousy or something, especially if it's something like fear or sadness. Maybe I don't want to feel bad when I meditate. I'm trying to make myself feel good. But the art of this meditation is both to learn to take something in and at the same time not to take it personally and not to identify with it. So often the way that we get caught by our experiences is we measure the experiences, our emotional states, our thoughts, our beliefs, in reference to what it does to me, what it means for me as a person, as an individual, as a self. There's a lot of selfing that goes on, a lot of this conceit that we talked about last week. So a person, you might come to meditate and feel fear, and they might think, oh no, I'm not supposed to be afraid, I'm meditating. Or you feel angry. Oh no, I'm with all these good Buddhists. I'm not supposed to be angry because Buddhists don't get angry, right? And so that's kind of stopping, interrupting the taking in of the anger or the fear by some judgment idea that this shouldn't be here. Or there could be the idea, oh, I'll be overwhelmed by this. This is too much for me. That's also an idea of self. This is too much for me. So what is the art? We learn this art slowly over time of how to sit still for what our experience is. So this taking in of our experience has a lot to do with being still and seeing how still can I be and still take in what's going on. So I think many of you had the experience of, I mean, I'm sure you've all had experiences of somehow or other taking things in that have been, you know, come banging on your door really loud. Sometimes you get sick, you know, some major sickness. Some of you might have been even dying, or you know someone who's dying. Or some of you might, had a death in your family. Or some of you might suddenly have some kind of financial crisis. Or some of you might have an earthquake, you know? We're all talking about thinking about earthquakes these days, right? Some of us, reading, especially if you read the Chronicle. I don't know, I don't read the Mercury News, so maybe they ignore it down there. But in 2 days we have this anniversary of the 1906 earthquake. And in times like that, we take in what it is to be a human being in a very different way than we go about life blissfully ignorant of the fragility of our lives. So we take it in, and then people sometimes will change their life based on what they've taken in. what they really experienced. I remember once I did a guided meditation on dying for some people. And at the end of the... the woman didn't tell me right away, but she told me, I think, some weeks later. She said that at the end of that guided meditation on dying, she decided to quit her job. I said, uh-oh, what did I do? And now it's been, I think, 11 years since that time. And she's really happy she did that. It's, you know, really the right thing for her to do. And the kind of corporate job she had was just full of stress, and she didn't have her heart in it anymore. And somehow taking in the fragility of life and death and somehow changed her. She stood underneath her death, in a sense, took that in, and that allowed her to change. I would like to read this poem by Wendell Berry that in my mind speaks to all this. I go among trees and sit still. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them, asleep like cattle. Then, what is afraid of me comes and lives a while in my sight. What it fears in me leaves me, and the fear of me leaves it. It sings, and I bear its song. Then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. So we sit still. And then as we sit there, things will come visiting us. In this poem, it's his fear. What things that are afraid of him. And you sit there and you watch it. You look at it. You be with it. You take it in. And allow it to somehow find that way that taking something in heals us. Taking something in transforms us. Taking something in informs us into a better life for ourselves. So we come to compassion or kindness or love. So it's my understanding or my belief, my experience, that as we get stiller and we allow ourselves to take things in, it passes through the outer layers of our psychology. So if we're restless or busy or agitated, we're kind of like on the surface of our lives. Or if we're always being egotistical, always about me, 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 we're kind of on the surface of our heart, on the outside of our mind. And as we learn to kind of quiet the mind or the heart, the surface stuff, so their experiences can penetrate more deeply, then it touches something that is very tender or very loving or very beautiful, that I like to call something that's very shy. And the most beautiful parts of our psychology, our inner life, I think of as being quite shy, because if you are overly busy, overly anxious, overly ambitious, overly entertained, that shy thing is not going to show itself. But that shy thing is, I think, the most precious thing that we have. And it's the wellspring of compassion and kindness. So to learn the art of taking things in and being still enough so we can take it in into the center of who we are, then it somehow vibrates in there, that place that is love or compassion. So this is a beautiful poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's titled Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that rises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. It's kindness that says, "It is I that you've been looking for." So this poem puts tremendous value on our sorrow, or in seeing the suffering of the world, experiencing the world as it actually is. Because in seeing that, or taking that in, standing under it, that then we can, it begins transforming the heart, transforming us in some way. It allows that little spark, or that little place, vibrate, that shy place, where kindness shows itself. Kindness and compassion, I don't think are something that are discovered in the abstract. You know, you can read all the books you want about compassion, or get all the I can give you like a list of 10 reasons why it's really good for human beings to become compassionate. And you might agree with the list, but that's not where compassion arises. I think for compassion to arise genuinely, it has to be in contact with the suffering of the world, both with our own suffering and ourselves, and the suffering the world has. So what is it to take that in such a way that it's productive, it's useful for you and for the world? So to sit still and take it in, feel it, and let it somehow change you. If we try to fix things too quickly, or to solve things too quickly, or try to have understanding in the usual way of trying to have knowledge about something, or to judge it or put it in its place, we might not have let it kind of settle into our hearts, kind of taking it in. And taking it in is sometimes a slow process. Taking an experience into our heart, there's no map that says how long it should be there, or how you're supposed to experience it, or what's supposed to happen. It's all kind of a mystery. It's unknown a little bit what happens. And my understanding of this process, the value of taking in, is not something that I was taught, but something I realized in retrospect after many, many years of sitting in meditation. You know, I would sit in monasteries, I would sit in many meditation centers, and it was just what we did. We sat, we sat, we sat. Get up every morning and just sit 2 periods of meditation. In the evening you'd sit, during the day you'd sit, there's a lot of sitting. And so sitting, meditation, was, you know, you couldn't run away, I couldn't run away from myself. All the stuff was there, just there and there and there. And so I would sit with this stuff, and sit with it, and sit with it. And my early years of sitting, I was quite lucky, I feel, because I didn't have any idea that it should be any different. I didn't have an idea that, oh, you know, it's supposed to be, you know. I was too naive. That it's, you know, so I would just sit there and my thoughts and my feelings and just sit there and sit there. The practice I had was practice of accepting what's happening in the present moment. So just sit there with what is. And that, and then slowly sitting there with what is, sitting there with what is, allows what is to be taken in. To sit there and be still, and try to be still with it, and then take it in. I discovered that slowly I was transformed and changed. So much so that I joke now sometimes that in my early practice, early years of practice, I was in a sense pursuing enlightenment. And what happened to me against my plans was compassionment. And I'm very grateful. It was very important for me. And that experience of being compassionate by the practice was something that happened very slowly by allowing my heart to be open to take in the experience of being a human being. George Washington Carver said, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and the strong. Because someday in life, you will have been all of these." So many people call upon us to be compassionate and kind. What I'd like to suggest here today is that being compassionate and kind, it shouldn't be something that we impose on ourselves. Oh, now I should be this way. I should go out and find someone to be compassionate with. But rather, compassionate and kindness is something that can sprout, can blossom from within us. If we allow ourselves to stand under our experience, to take it in, to be in standing with our stand in our experience, and stand in with it in a kind of quality way that allows the experience to affect us. So that takes time. So sitting, meditation is one thing that gives us time. Sitting and having a cup of tea, looking out a window, is giving your this shy part of your heart very important time to take things in and experience what's going on. Quiet time, silent time, time of solitude, taking a long walk in the woods, for example, another way. So finding the ways of contemplative life is to find ways to allow the heart, the shy part of the heart, to take things in, to experience what's going on. And then, if we do that, and let this thing blossom inside of us, then perhaps we can come to say what Gandhi said. "To come to the heart of truth, one must be able to love the meanest creature as oneself. And those who think that religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion really means." One must be able to love the meanest creature as oneself. So it takes sitting still, so we can take in the other person. So not reading statistics in the newspaper about people, but to take it in. Take it in. Today in the Chronicle, there was the usual kind of headline someplace in the Chronicle about the kind of thing where three people were killed in a bar late Friday night, I think. And I just glanced at the headlines and said, "Well, this, you know, it's so easy to read these things." And I just kind of let it go, didn't read it. Then I turned the page, and I guess somehow this article continued later on in the Chronicle, like third or fourth page. And then it said something about Redwood City. I said, "Oh, they're killing each other in Redwood City." So then I went back and read the newspaper. And then I read that article and allowed myself to take it in. And it was very touching for me, very meaningful to me in a sense, to take that in and realize, you know, almost down the street, the other end of town, people are killing each other. So what does that mean to take that in right here in our community? And then Gandhi says, and I'll end with this, he says, And those who think that religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion really means. I think if we begin having some taste, some experience of the shy place of compassion, or some experience of compassion, that compassion is not something we do exactly, but something we are, then to be true to what we are would be to begin acting on that compassion, expressing it. So compassion becomes expression of who we are rather than a duty. And that then our life then spills over into the lives of others and caring for others. A life without caring for others, or say it this way, a Buddhist practice that doesn't care for others sooner or later becomes a dead end. So sooner or later, I think caring for others becomes a natural part of the outgrowth of this shy thing. And hopefully, eventually stops being shy. So, those are my thoughts. And I hope that's been helpful and you're willing to maybe try taking things in. Give yourself the time. And if this talk didn't make any sense, then stand under some other tree. Thank you very much.